We now turn to 16th and 17th century theologians who reflected on questions pertaining more at the end of life and who raised issues that would resurface in our own day in regard to questions of nutrition and hydration and the moral obligation to employ medical means that are either expensive or experimental or carry some risk. The first whom I'd like to look at is listed under number 2.1, and that is the Dominican Francisco de Vitoria. And both he and the other theologian whom we will be considering, the Jesuit Juan Cardinal de Lugo, are both individuals who are looked to by later moralists, and especially by Alphonsus Liguori and the sort of acme period in moral theology that he represents, as important precedents. And they're also reminders of the fact that many of the issues that we are struggling with in our own day have in fact been part of ongoing theological and moral discussion in the Catholic tradition for several centuries. Now, what I've included here is a summary of the thought of Vitoria and de Lugo's thought, contained in the document that I've given you as part of your course reading, and that is Gary Atkinson's excellent chapter on moral responsibility in prolonging life decisions, where he discusses the history of the tradition. And his summaries are given here on the webpage, and I'd like to note several things that I've highlighted. Vitoria, and again, it's not that these are the only, in any sense, the only issues he raises, but he does raise questions that are very significant in regard to the issue of food, nutrition, and hydration in unusual circumstances. Vitoria asks whether a person is always obliged to preserve their life based on their inclination towards self-preservation, and he points out that not preserving one's life could involve the charge of suicide, but he, in answering this discussion, or in reflecting on this discussion, raises what Atkinson describes as eight important points. The first is, number one, if you are sick, you're required to take food if there exists some hope of life, if there is reasonable hope that this particular means will sustain life. But, he says, if the patient is so depressed or they've lost their appetite so that it is only with the greatest effort that they can eat food, then this, he says, creates a kind of impossibility, and the patient is excused, now excused at least from the mortal sin of being responsible for the ending of their own life, especially if there's little or no hope of life. So there are circumstances which can create a kind of impossibility for the individual in regard to their eating. Now, he may be thinking of the moral question, I should say of the physical question, of simple eating, and particularly at the end of life, as those who have been involved in the care of the dying know, there is a natural process, a point at which the dying simply do not wish to eat or drink, and to force food on them, especially as their bodies lose the capacity to absorb food, is actually an act of torture. It is not in any sense an act of compassion, and the Church very clearly recognizes this, as we shall see, and recommends very specifically palliative care. Pope John Paul II, as we shall see, had a document specifically dedicated to the importance of palliative care as a form of charity, and this is something that recurs in the Catechism of the Church. This is anticipated here in this reflection that there may be circumstances under which eating and drinking for the individual is only possible with the greatest effort, and that therefore the person could perhaps be excused from doing this. And for him, the obligation to take drugs is even less serious. He points out that food is a means normally, naturally ordered toward the life of the creature, whereas drugs are not. One might parenthetically add that there were no specific drugs that cured disease at this time, and so the obligation would, of course, have been significantly lower in that context, as contrasted with our own day, where there are drugs drugs, which, depending on the nature and the extremity of the side effects, may become morally obligatory as they offer more and more hope of restoring a person to life and health. And that's exactly what he points out in number four, that, again, remember that this is very early in the availability of effective medication of any kind, but he said if there were moral certainty that a drug would return one to health, that you would die otherwise, then the use of that drug would be obligatory. However, he points out that since it's rarely the case that drugs do that, it's not mortally sinful to state that one simply doesn't want to take medications. Now, that would, in our own day, have to be balanced against the nature of the side effects and the and perhaps, as we'll see also, the question of the burden to the individual, and that might include financial burden as experienced by the individual themselves. He points out in point six, it's one thing not to protect or prolong life. It is another thing to destroy it. A person is not always obliged to prolong life. And number seven, to fulfill the obligation to protect life, it is sufficient to perform that by which a person can regularly live. Per quam homo regulariter potest vivere. This will later come into the category of what will be described as ordinary versus extraordinary. One is normally, not always, but normally obliged to make use of what are described as ordinary means. But, one has to add, and this is already prefigured in both of these theologians, there is no absolute black and white list of means that are always ordinary, even though one can say that certain means are always extraordinary because they would always involve great pain or effort. But the question of what it is a person requires to regularly live, as we'll see, this enters into an element of subjectivity. The amount of pain or discomfort or burden that an individual themselves experiences, which really cannot be adequately measured or assessed by anyone other than the individual. And this is a point that is beginning to be hinted at this point and will become more explicit as time goes by. So, as we'll see, this is a kind of an anticipation of the notion of ordinary versus extraordinary, which, of course, today, as we know, tends to fade in contrast with the language of proportionate versus disproportionate modalities, that is to say, means that are appropriate for the achieving of a particular goal, looking at what it is you want to achieve and how much pain, suffering, and other burden you would have to impose as a result of that. Well, again, these questions are beginning to be anticipated here, and it's why I've included the little pictures of uncommon foods which are available now, of which Vittoria would never have thought. And that's particularly parenteral food that can be offered via the nose, via a tube going directly into the abdomen or into the intestines. I've included a little picture showing all the various kinds of liquid forms of food that are available. And then, of course, there is both IV therapy and, in extraordinary, unusual circumstances, intravenous parenteral nutrition as well. That is to say, a person can receive nutrition through a vein and not just through the digestive tract. Well, that's simply to remind us of some of the issues that exist today, which to some extent are being hinted at the questions that De Vittoria is raising. And so if we drop down to number eight, he says, and this is a very important point that is still the case today, although many people don't realize it, thus a sick person would not be required to use a drug that they could not obtain except by giving over their whole means of subsistence. In other words, a person is not required to sell everything they have in order to obtain a medical therapy that would even reasonably prolong their life. One of the things that would be suggested by moralists is that this would particularly be the case if one wanted to have a legacy to pass on to one's heirs, that one would not be obliged to deprive those who would come afterwards of any inheritance for the sake of prolonging one's life. But he in this particular context of number 8, points out that you would not be obliged to move to a more healthful location. And in another text, he lists as delicate foods, foods that you would not be required to eat if they were absolutely necessary for life, hens and chickens. And again, this is something that that would reflect the capacity to eat meat in a sort of a more upper middle class or upper class context. The individual could legitimately choose to eat ordinary food even if they knew that the only way to survive for them to continue living would be to eat this unusual or delicate food. So he says, and this is in the paragraph that follows number 8, one is not obliged to employ all the means to conserve life, but it is sufficient to employ the means which are themselves intended for this purpose and congruent. And then finally, if you drop down to the portion that I've highlighted in white, what produces a kind of impossibility, and no one's obliged to do the impossible, need not be the means themselves, but the way they are subjectively experienced by the individual. The individual patient may have, and this will later be clearer in the writings of Alphonsus Liguori, a subjective repugnance or a kind of a vehement horror, a psychological or spiritual sense of being absolutely opposed to a particular means, which means that the obligation to preserve life, as I've highlighted here, is neither absolute nor invariant, but can depend on the unique circumstances of the individual. Now, all of this is always understood as existing against the backdrop of one does not intend death. That is, if one chooses to abstain from medication or from particular kinds of food in this context, it's not because one wants to die, but because one recognizes that using all these regarded as burdensome modalities, one simply wants to not be obliged to make use of the burden, and the effect of shortening life is a secondary and unintended effect. And a simple test would be, well, if it would be possible to continue your life and the means used would not imply or require that kind of perhaps subjective repugnance, would you employ them? And if the answer is yes, I would prefer to live, then it's not a question of intending to die by refusing those modalities, and it could be legitimate to refuse. If we drop down now to the text number 2.1 by the Jesuit Juan Cardinal de Lugo in the next century, that is to say the early and middle part of the 17th century, he asks questions in regard to the kind of medical care one must accept, not so much in regard to food per se, but he asks it in the context of mutilation, and this would particularly be a painful surgical procedures. He notes, as we've already seen, that Aquinas argued that mutilations are wrong if they're not necessary for the body's health, but the question that de Lugo is asking is, when are they necessary? One of the questions that will be asked by him and by others is, must you always submit to what your doctor tells you to do? Must you always submit to a painful surgical procedure? And in general, the answer was, only if it holds an overwhelming probability of success and of returning you to some form of health. And in specific here, Cardinal de Lugo points out, and this is in the highlighted section, that a person must permit a cure when the doctors judge it necessary and also when it can be accomplished without intense pain, which would have been almost impossible in the case of an amputation. So at this period, many would argue that even if an amputation were life-saving, one would not be obliged to accept it because of the pain and suffering that it entailed. And so I've highlighted, not if it's accompanied by very bitter pain, a man is not bound to employ, and here is the term used, extraordinary and difficult means, extraordinaria et difficilima media. One is not obliged to employ these kinds of means in order to conserve life. And here too, extraordinary does not mean, it's not just a question of whether it's available or easy to use. It has to do here specifically with the particular individual's experience of subjective suffering. So the definition of ordinary versus extraordinary is not just an objective assessment of how easily available this means is, but how is this experienced by the individual. And then if we drop down a little bit later in that paragraph, he points out that an example of a means that would be difficult to employ, or a means that that he would say would be optional, would be a mutilation involving intense or bitter pain, and this would particularly have been the case in regard to amputation. So he points out that other means would have to do with choice or costly medicine, or he says even the drinking of, if one were opposed to it, or the abstaining from, if one derived pleasure from it, wine. So he is secondarily raising the question of nutrition or hydration, or of eating particular kinds of food. And here again, we're finding ourselves recognizing that the term that becomes very appropriate for and very commonly used in our moral tradition prior to relatively recent times, that is the notion of extraordinary versus ordinary, is profoundly dependent on the individual's experience. Personal, unique experience, which may vary according to their psychological or social or spiritual context. And we'll see this particularly highlighted by Alphonsus Liguori in a further lecture. And if we drop down to the later paragraph that's highlighted, Vittoria points out that the taking of food is obligatory if there exists some hope of life. And this would not have been, in his day, simply the prolongation of life by a few days or a few weeks, but some hope of a return to life by taking food. So if there is no real preservation of a state of living, then there would not be a corresponding moral obligation to make use of it. So it's intriguing to see that these questions, which become very important in modern times in regard to the care that one is obliged to offer to, particularly to the profoundly disabled, and that would include those in a persistent vegetative state, which, as we'll see, Pope John Paul II particularly highlighted, that is very different from the context of someone who has reached the end of life. As we'll see, people in a persistent vegetative state are not dying. They are in a state in which, if they receive ordinary means, they will continue to live. But people who are at the end of life may experience what would be ordinary for other people as difficult or burdensome, and they would not necessarily be obliged to make use of those means. These are not just questions that have been raised in relatively recent times. As we see, they were already being discussed rather intensely in the 16th and 17th centuries.